Oh, yeah.
Good evening. My name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank God you found my jacket. No, I'd like to thank Spearheads and the Primary Purpose Group and the Perimeter Group for flying Skip out here. I was sober for about 7 years, and I was thinking about killing myself, and I was fortunate enough to meet Skip, and he showed me a new way to work the steps, a way to get closer to God. He has helped hundreds and hundreds of people. He leads groups. He has a full schedule. He has a great message, and I hope you enjoy listening to him. Skip.
Thank you, Steve.
Good evening. My name is Skip, and I am most definitely an alcoholic.
Hey, Skip.
I want to thank everybody that, you know, had a part in getting me out here, and I thank Steve. Steve's like one of my favorite people in the world, and it's somebody that, you know, kind of like this program, and it talks about on page 17, we're a group that normally wouldn't mix, you know, and the boat, the ship that it talks about going down when everybody's saved, they go on their separate ways and away they go. But here, we're sharing the common peril, you know, and we need each other, you know. God, I can't believe I'm getting all emotional all of a sudden. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and what the big book has to offer me. I came from there was often times when I was growing up that I wished I was dead before I was even 10 years old. There wasn't a situation I went into where I had any confidence at all going into. There was, I had grandparents instead of parents. And in 1963, when they were raising me, it was just another indicator where God had left me out of the equation, you know, where every place I looked at, there was an indicator of how I fell short or how I was victimized of some way. When I found what was ultimately going to save my life and bring me to a place that I never dreamed of being, alcohol, and a few other of those non-AA approved substances. I truly believe it kept me alive long enough to make it to these rooms. Because had I not had it, who knows what the story would have been. You know, the idea in my mind from early on was that, you know, and the book's clear on it, if I could just change a situation, then I would have been okay. You know, if I would have just had parents, like every other human being on the planet seemed to have at that time, then I would have been okay. And if I would have just went to normal schools instead of sending away to school for 5 years in fifth grade on, then I probably would have been okay. And, you know, I started the delusion in my mind where I had to have this fantasy that was going on, you know. Talks about in the book of not being able to differentiate the truth from the false. You know, I think I even actually started to believe all the lies I told myself. I mean, I got so good at telling them that they became a part of my life, you know. Like when I was in military school, I would tell everybody about this amazing family I had at home and all these brothers and sisters that I had, you know, and how incredibly cool I was in the neighborhood. And then when I was home from military school, I was telling about all these incredible things I did and how cool I was at the campus and how I was number one in this and that. And, you know, the reality is, you know, I had 5 years of military school and I was in the Marine Corps for almost 2 years. And I never got over one stripe, you know what I mean? So, like, my ability to lead, which I thought I had, you know, like in Bill's story, was... I imagine, you know, definitely. So, you know, I did really crazy shit too. I I remember I was, I would, you know the Letterman's jacket, you know, they would have this Letterman's jacket where, you know the sports people that were lettered in sport could wear this jacket. But they had another letter at our school where if you weren't, you could have one, but you couldn't sew it on anything, which was lame. So on the way home, I would sew it on my jacket. So by the time I got home, I'd walk around town, you know, so I could look like I was somebody, you know. And then I would tear it off. And I remember the humility that I felt, you know, in the incomprehensible demoralization, the pitiful incomprehensible demoralization of being caught in some situations of being this ultimate liar, you know. The definition that we use in the groups I'm at is that the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization is doing the things I told myself I'd never do, you know. And there was a lot of them. I felt that a lot of times. So, you know, every job I had, every relationship I had, everything I got into, I got in behind alcohol. And everyone I lost behind alcohol. I was totally into that. You know, I didn't know anything about my internal condition, but when I first read doctor's opinion and saw that restless irritable discontent, I knew they were talking about me. I knew that as soon as my eyes were open to this world, it was just very terrifying for me. I didn't know how to do anything, and I thought I'd never measure up. So it continued, you know. I ended up, you know, destroying a lot of stuff, forging a lot of checks, ripping everybody off that I came in contact with, getting a lot of trouble, and I ended up going through my first treatment center in 1986. And I managed to stay, which I alluded to last night as well, is that, you know, I have this friend David that says that, you know, when you're totally tied to any committee that's going on or taking place, and you're at the meeting before the meeting, and you're at the meeting after the meeting, and then you're on every committee and you're volunteering for any kind of thing that's going on, and you don't do any steps. You're at step zero. And I was at step zero the whole time I was in my first bit of recovery, which lasted almost 15 years. I don't recommend it. You know, the book's real clear on those middle-of-the-road solutions, you know, and that's one of them. You know, on page 17, it alludes that, you know, that I talked about the unity of this fellowship, which is half the foundation of this program. But that of itself isn't enough for me to stay sober. You know what I mean? I thought that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just being in the rooms meant that I was in recovery. You know, and I thought that, you know, the steps were for people that couldn't get things going on as quickly as I could. So since I got things going on very quickly and ended up making some loot and getting that smoking hot girl in the room at 30 days. And you know what I mean? And then she was pregnant at 4 months, you know, and setting up house and building businesses that I really didn't have time to do these steps. And I really didn't see how they affected my life. You know, because I didn't know that I was so sick. You know, I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes we really just don't know how sick we are. You know, we think that everything's cool. At least I do, you know. It's like, I talked about how, you know, I finished the 12 steps. I'm totally in line with God. I'm walking hand in hand. I'm aligned. I'm living in step 10 and 11. I'm taking tons of people through the steps. I'm active in the fellowship. But I'm not doing any work at the time. And I think, you know, God starts to become my little helper. Instead of me totally devoted to, you know, being who God would have me be. And the funny thing is my ego says, you know what, Skip, don't sweat it. I'll let you know when you need to redo these steps. You know? It's a liar. You know what I mean? It's my ego can't tell when it's time to do them, when it isn't. So, you know, I ended up getting loaded after almost 15 years. And I think I was loaded way before I went out, you know? Seriously, you know? And I destroyed a lot of stuff. And when I was out those 4 years, I prayed often that God would take me because I no longer wanted to be around anymore. I had embarrassed myself in a lot of way, you know, a lot of areas, and you know, there's a part in the book where it talks about reservations, you know, and I think that, you know, when I'm taking people through the work, I'm going to talk about reservations, because I think reservations are important to talk about. I didn't know I had a reservation my first bout of sobriety, but I absolutely did. I had a reservation that, You know, in the doctor's opinion, when he talks about frothy emotional appeal, seldom suffices. You know what I mean? And when my grand, when I'm working with someone, I'm going to ask them, who were those people that were begging you to stop? You know, and when I think back, it was my grandfather. My grandfather was the most amazing, loving, wonderful man in the world. I mean, it also asks, who are your heroes? You know, he was, today he's my hero. You know, back then he wasn't. But I would look at his face and visualize it in my eyes, and I think, I surely don't want him to have to bury me like he had to bury his daughter, you know, when I was 4 years old. So I stayed sober on that alone, you know what I mean? And then when he died, I was loaded. And then when I went through the steps, finally, you know, I drank for 4 years. I was at a bar, one of my normal drinking places, and one of the fellows that was a security guard asked me, have I ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought that was kind of an odd question to ask me in a bar. And I said, well, why do you ask? He said, because half the stuff I hear out of your mouth, I hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous out on the patio, because, you know, I was a smoker at the time, and I was on the patio all the time, and he'd work the gate, and I'd go, yeah, you know, managing everybody's life, you know? And he says, you know, we're saving you a seat. And I, you know, I had been, you know, I 4 weeks earlier, I had gotten pulled over for drunk driving, and the cops let me go. The cops had been in my house probably 10 times in a couple years, and you know that look, you know, through the front door of someone's pad that there's something really bad going on in there? You know what I mean? Like, there was times where it was more important for me to anesthetize myself instead of taking my dogs out. You know what I mean? And life got so busy doing that, there was times where it sat for a long time. And the cops would show up because from time to time I had to get my chick's attention. And the police would be called, you know, and it just, all you had to do was look through the front door and know something was really bad going on in there, you know? And it never happened. And I started putting everything together, and I started thinking, you know, my kid's going to move down here with me. It's about time that I probably step up and make some changes in my life. So that night, you know, it was almost closing time, and you know how you're at the bar and you're trying to find that place of ease and comfort that the book talks about, and you just haven't got there yet, and it's closing, you know, and you're looking around to see who else hasn't gotten to that place that you've covered, and you're looking to prolong that party. But that was like on a Saturday night. Come Thursday, when I was supposed to take a band I was managing up to L.A. to win this award, I was still in the mix of getting that place that you've covered. And you know, it was ugly. I mean, I was a mess. I was like, you know, the look. The shades are drawn, and it was ugly. So I told them that, you know, I'd been clean before. I think I can do this again. So I decided to go back and get sober again. I walked through the rooms, and I remember being terrified walking across that threshold, you know. The hardest thing, I think, that having time in Alcoholics Anonymous is not being able to go tell somebody that you're hurting and not being able to tell someone that you're dying inside and that you need some help. And that's exactly what happened to me in all those years. My life was crazy, but my ego was so big, I couldn't go to anybody and tell them that I was dying and I needed some help, you know? So I went to this, and the first meeting I sat at, I heard all the things I needed to hear, you know? So I got busy because I think, you know, most meetings you go to, you're hearing about that you need to get busy. So I went back to school, I quit smoking, I did all these things, you know what I mean? You know, just meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, you know? You know, it's funny, I always talk shit about the people that have to plan a meeting when they're going out of town, you know? And I says, you know, 10, 11, and 12, you were like busily in those steps. It says that I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. You know, if tempted, I'll recoil like a hot flame. Think that means while you're on vacation too, you know what I mean? So, you know, so I don't have to plan where I'm going, like, you know. So I started on the journey, man, and then I went on treatment for hepatitis C. My life came to a stop. You know, I was doing some businesses. I had to stop that, and I was like curled up in a ball at home going through this thing. And there's this workshop that was starting. And this is oddly enough, it's only a little over 6 years ago that I attended this workshop I went to, and it changed my life. You know, I sat in the room, and the woman that ultimately became my sponsor that was leading it was talking about, you know, the circle and triangle of this program, and talking about how important the circle and triangle was before there's a couple versions of why it's not in there anymore. And one is that they didn't want to have to go to court and sue people over using the circle and triangle, and the other one was that time passed and they forgot to renew the copyright. So I don't know which one to believe, and I don't think it really makes any difference. But when I'm working with someone, I'm having them draw that circle and triangle back in their book and talk about the 36 spiritual principles that are tied to that circle and triangle. One of which is the unity. And she described, you know, the unity being one-third this triangle. And am I connected to meetings? Am I connected to too many meetings? Am I so connected to meetings that maybe I could take a couple nights off and start taking people through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? Then she talked about the unity or the service part of it. She talked about the service isn't making coffee for a meeting. That's not the service that they're talking about in the book. And that service, making coffee at a meeting, is important to the fellowship. You know, it's service to the fellowship as opposed to the service that they're talking about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she talked about recovery portion of this thing. She talked about not letting my last memory of my last work, you know what I mean? It says if AA is the steps and taking people through the 12 steps and working the steps, where am I at in AA? And she said that if I was balanced in all three of those areas, that I could be whole. And the first night I heard that, I almost started crying. Because it was something that, you know, I've had times in my life where things were kind of cool, you know, and then I'd screw it up, you know what I mean? Because, because I'm the actor wanting to be the director, and if I get the play to sit a certain way, once it starts to get close, then I change what I need in that play. Because I'm crazy, you know what I mean? You know, I mean, can you relate to that? I'm nuts, man. I go, if I just get her, just get this job, just get to, then everything will be okay. I get all that. And then I go, well, maybe it wasn't her. Maybe it's her. You know what I mean? You know, seriously. You know? So I embarked on this journey, man. And 3 months through the steps, I started looking for people to take through the steps. And the first time I was sober, I'm really sick, man. I got a cold right when I got on the plane, I think. But I'll get through it. I started running around looking for people to do the steps, you know. And as I'm going through my work, you know, I'm bouncing all over the place. Bear with me. But I remember getting like 3 months, almost 4 months in, and I go up to Tyler, wasn't my sponsor at the time, and I said, Tyler, I mean, is it okay if I like start taking people through the steps? She goes, well, how long have you been sober? And I go, a year. And she goes, okay, go ahead. You know, and you know, and as long as I stayed ahead of them, I could take them through the steps. And I'm running around, and people would do it for like 1 week because it's hardcore. I mean, there's some things that we ask of you to do. You know, are you willing to go to any lengths? You know, there's some writing that's attached to this. There's a couple hours of homework every week. It's like, how desperate are you to find a place of ease and comfort from doing this work as opposed to pornography or shopping or gambling? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we straighten out physically and mentally, but if we don't straighten out spiritually, we're going to find somewhere else to find that ease and comfort. Or at least I did. You know, I can't speak for y'all, but so you know, I'm running up and down the road, beating my chest about how wonderful this is, and the book describes that too, you know, that we're not holier than thou. You know, all we have is we just want to be helpful, you know, to take someone through the steps. And as soon as I finished them, I started them over again. And I got to tell you, there's some amazing stuff in this book. You know, when I go through the doctor's opinion, it talks about me having an allergy, you know, and we equate that to if I had an allergy to strawberries, and if I eat strawberries, I broke out in a rash. Well, the rash that I have with alcoholism is that when I ingest a drink into my system, there's a kick off in a phenomenon of craving for more alcohol, you know, almost all the time, you know, because I'm going to hold on to that one time or two times where it didn't have happened, you know what I mean? Because that's how we are, you know what I mean? You know, I want to find every reason to not be a part of this. It talks about that I drank because I like the effect produced. Absolutely, you know? You know, now I do the steps because I like the effect produced. Then it talks about that I'm restless, irritable, discontent. And until I can get to that place of ease and comfort, which the alcohol brings me, you know, then I'll be searching for that ease and comfort again. And I'm going to find it somewhere else. And if I don't find, I'll succumb to the drink idea again, you know. Then it shoots me off into Bill's story, you know. And I go through Bill's story and I look everywhere in there where, you know, when I first read it, I had nothing in common with Bill. He was a stockbroker. He was educated. He was married. He was all these things I wasn't. But when I go through there and I underline everywhere I thought, drank, or felt like him, I have everything in common with him. And the more times I go through Bill's story, I have even more and more in common with him. You know, did he drink when he was lonely? I drank when I was lonely. Was there ominous warnings in my life? Of course there was. There was ominous warnings from the first day I ingested alcohol into my system. You know, I was a mess ever since that day forward. You know? And it's about putting my story with that story. And it talks about fancying himself a leader. I already talked about that. I only got one stripe, you know? You know, my ability to lead vast enterprises, I imagined. You know what I mean? You know, that was my life. I thought I was so important, but I was hardly anything of that. You know, at the beginning, he talks about drinking when everything was good. You know, he talks about, later he says, you know, he did geographics. He stole from his wife. She'd go work at Piggly Wiggly, and he'd steal $10 out of her purse. You know what I mean? You know, I can relate. You know, I was a thief. You know, he says, and the best part, you know, was when the quicksand stretched around him in all directions, he'd met his match. So, you know, alcohol become his master. And when I look back, I go, what was going on in your life when it became your master? You know what I mean? How did that look? Every time it became your master, you know? I thought when I had all those years that I could just snap my fingers and get sober again. It wasn't the case. You know, it took me 4 years to get back to this room. I thought as soon as I got rid of her, it'd be all good. I'd be back in the rooms and away we go. And it surely didn't work like that, you know? So I go from there into there's a solution. You know what I mean? Thank goodness they have a chapter named that right after Bill's story. You know, there's a solution. You know, because I surely need one because I'm so pissed off, you know? The reason I didn't hit on the last half of that is where he finds his recovery is because when we go through the work, we go back to him finding the recovery after step 11, and we read about all those things. But we used to do it where underline all the things you're unwilling to do. You know what I mean? And I found myself not being unwilling to do anything. You know, I found myself going through this work and doing the steps with the desperation of a drowning man, like the book describes. The physical is all the way to the top of 23. When I look back at that, you know, I look at, you know, some guides on what to look for in a sponsor. You know how when we get here, they say, you know, find somebody that's got what you want. You know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of crazy for us to tell people. You know what I mean? Because when we get here, we don't know what the hell we want. You know what I mean? You know, and those the kind of sponsors I picked the first time I was here. People who didn't do any steps out of the book. People that just hung out and became my friends, you know, that really never gave me any direction in this program. So at the top of 23, it says that all this would be academic and pointless if I just never picked up the first drink, setting this cycle in motion, you know. And how'd that work? You know what I mean? That's what I got to ask myself. How did it work with me having some knowledge about me, myself, with me having the nudge from the judge? You know what I mean? How did that, my mind always take me back? That my mind will always take me back every single time, even when I don't want to. And how can I trust that I can just wake up in the morning and choose not to drink? You know? I mean, if I could choose not to drink in the morning, I wouldn't be here in Atlanta burning like hell. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not going to lie. You know, I'd come out here, but it surely wouldn't be in an AA meeting. You know, I mean, if I could choose not to drink, you know, because the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. But it's not the only requirement to stay sober. You know, it's just a desire for membership. I mean, there's a lot of requirements laid out in the big book. You know, I like talking about, you know, just before, you know, I like to tie my story to like those things when my mind wouldn't, you know, I couldn't stop. You know, it's like, I remember I was on probation for sales, you know, of something other than alcohol. And I was looking at 3 years in the penitentiary. I was testing the next day, okay? I mean, just the next day, you know, like the next day. And I could not get loaded that night, you know? Sufficient reason, I can't stop, you know? And this is, you know, is this going on with you? I mean, sufficient reason and loss of control are the two things that separate me from a real, from a hard drinker. Sufficient reason I can't stop. You know, one of my workshops, I think it was last year, we had like 60 people in this. And we went around the room, and I asked each person to tell me, what was the most sufficient reason that you had to stop and you couldn't stop? It was heartbreaking. You know, by the time I got to the eighth person, I wished I'd never even would have started it. You know, it was just like, I was pregnant and couldn't stop, you know? I was looking at losing my children and couldn't stop. I was looking at the penitentiary and couldn't stop. I was looking at never getting my kids back again and couldn't stop. I mean, these are really good excuses. I mean, really good reasons to stop, yet we can't stop. So the problem lies in my mind, not in my body, you know? And the only answer I've got to solve this thing is a spiritual solution. And how do I get there? How do I get the desperation for the spiritual solution when I'm filled with agnosticism and I'm filled with, you know, doubt and prejudice about it even working in my life? Although I see it working in other people's lives. You know, when I was at this workshop, I saw what Bill described when he saw Ebby, that he was fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes, you know? I saw that in the people that were at this workshop, and I sure to hell wanted what they had. I just didn't know how to get there. You know, when I got up into, you know, We Agnostics, and I started looking at what I'm up against and what is my present-day agnosticism. You know, every time I go through the steps, I'm not going to lie to you. I get up to that, and I go, what's my present-day agnosticism? Is that I believe that there is a God, but will he be there for me? Every time I'm asking myself that. And yet, I've got years of evidence where God has been with me the entire time, even when I didn't want him to be with me. You know what I mean? Even when I was completely ignoring him, shutting his door, you know? You know, and it gives us a lot of things from a simple understanding, you know? Our own conception, however inadequate, is enough to make the start. You know, and the steps unblock me from finding this relationship with God. And go. I always say that it says God 136 times in the first 164 pages. And I always say that, you know, if they wanted us to use a different word, they probably would have used a different word. But I think they want us to talk about God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? Right? Yeah, they want to pick something else. So when I look back at my earliest conception of what that is, and I'm working with somebody, I'm going to ask them, what was your relationship like with your parents? Because I think that's my first indicator on what my higher power is. And if I lacked in that place, even if it was delusional or not, I still lacked. Because I got to believe that some of the delusions that I had in my life ran my life, and I believed them like truth, even though that they weren't truth. So I'm going to ask them that. You know, it's like, well, my parents split up, my father was a rich, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm a software according, you know, where I feel that I really need to go in some areas, and some areas I'm a no-nonsense guy. I was just in the book, walked through it like every one of us did, and the first 100 did before us, get 50% sobered up at once and forever. I mean, isn't that the kind of recovery we're looking for? I mean, it's what I'm looking for. The book doesn't promise me day-at-a-time recovery. It promises me permanent recovery. You know what I mean? Recovered. You know what I mean? So I look at that, and I start to go through the stuff. At step two, I'm making a decision that maybe there is something out there. That maybe, even though I think I'm so brilliant, that maybe I'm off the mark when it comes to spiritual ideas, you know? And then when I look at step three and I look at the evidence of my life of trying to play God in every area, well, I typically see that in step one. Because the step one is totally me playing God. Every step that I'm unwilling to do, is based on step one. You know, my inability to start writing a four step is dependent upon how much I think the drink is to die, you know, from step one, and how I have no other choice. You know, at the ABCs, you know, the third and last, you know, the God couldn't weave, what if he were sought? I mean, could and what if he were sought doesn't mean that I don't do anything to seek him, you know? He could and what if he were sought means I need to be always seeking this higher power and this relationship with God, you know? And I don't know what that looks like for everybody, but for me, it's a daily process for me. Because today, it's like, you know, everybody's heard of Mark, right? Mark Houston, you know, he says, you know, I'm not willing to bet today is the day I won't be spiritually fit, you know? Everything I did up to yesterday was yesterday's spiritual journey. And today, every night I die, and every day I've got to be born again in this spiritual life. You know, I've gone to hell so many times that I surely want to stay in this, in the sunlight of the Spirit that the book describes, you know. So I go through step three, you know, and I look at, really, did I really try to, you know, it was the actor wanting to be the director, thinking I'm the director, you know, and I did that my whole life, man. You know, it's like, and I ruined a lot of lives as a result of it, you know. I think the most amazing line in the big book, so our problems we think of our own making, you know, because if my problems were of your making, there's no chance of me getting any better. You know what I mean? It's just like, if my problems are of my own making, then I can make some differences with God, because I can't pull it off on my own. There's nothing I can do on my own power. You know, lack of power is my dilemma. You know, it tells me a couple times on 46 that my job is to see. You know, it gives you some more requirements on 27. I love what Jung says, man. I always mess it up, so I'm going to read it. You know, Carl Jung, once this happens. You know, he says, it's funny, I'll tell you a story about all the big books I threw away when I lost my home that were on my bookshelf that were all brand new, you know. And I remember throwing them in the trash can thinking, I really wish these would have worked, you know. This is the first one I got, and I have like five of these, you know. This is like 6 years old. I mean, I'm in this thing every day because I want to, you know, because I want a deeper and closer relationship. So what does Carl say? One more page. He says, you know, he's talking to that guy that went to see him. It's like going to see Freud, you know what I mean? This guy's going to find out how, you know, he wants to stop drinking. And he had some self-knowledge and sent him on his way, and he came back drunk again. He says, I've never seen anybody recover for you in your case. He says, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. Something I can see, but I can't explain, phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, the way I thought, emotions, the way I felt, and attitudes, the way I believed, which were once the guiding forces of these lives, of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives began to dominate them. You know what I mean? And that's what I'm looking for. It's like Bill said, you know, common sense thus became uncommon sense. You know, anyway, the way he thought when he got here completely is rearranged, and now he thinks a whole different way. You know, his roots grasp new soil. You know what I mean? It's like, that's what I want from this work. And I'm not going to get there, and I'm not going to have a relationship with this guy. At two and three, it's just kind of like a concept. You know, it even describes that. And I'm going to search for this. You know, I'm going to do the third step decision and have a new direction in my life, that God's going to be my director, you know, and that he'll be the principal and I'll be his agent, and that he'll be the father and I'll be the child, you know. And I often think about that, you know, this is the one father that's never let me down since I've committed my life to this father-child relationship. You know, any other human would accept this relationship. So how I do that, I block myself with doing steps 4 through 9, you know. I like to talk about how crazy I am in my resentments, and how, you know, when I first started doing this, I had a couple hundred. But we're looking for the causes and conditions of this. You know what I mean? We're not looking. I think if I'm coming up with a couple hundred resentments, I'm going to build up too much of a barrier to get through, you know. Because I got to go, the book tells me I went back to the list of these resentments because I had to see where the fear drove my delusion, that drove the selfish thinking, that drove the self-seeking behavior, you know, every single one of them. And how because of the fear that drives this whole thing, I'm out of my mind and I'm all alone still at this point. I'm still can't walk hand in hand with my higher power. Is it always this hot in Atlanta?
It's always really hot.
Oh my God. I would hate the bottom out here. I would just being homeless and yeah, that would just suck. You know? I'm a Ritz-Carlton kind of bottom out guy. No, I'm kidding. So, you know, there's some beautiful things it tells me in the fifth step promises that I'll be able to look the world in the eye, you know? I mean, I never was able to look anybody in the eye, you know? Not even myself, you know? I mean that. I'd look in the mirror and I couldn't look at myself, man. I was so ashamed of what I did, you know? One of the, you know, and as I'm going through my piles of stuff in step six, yeah, I'm looking at the things that I see are objectionable, you know, and I'm ready to embark in that God's going to remove from me what He sees fit to remove from me, and that I'm not making a list, and that I'm crossing my fingers, hoping that He's not going to take some of the character defects that, you know, I'm not clinging to. I'm willing for Him to remove from me, but you know what I mean. You know, it's like, there's a couple that I think are kind of handy, you know, and then, you know, hook me up, bro, you know, it's like, you know, like, come on, man, you know, and then after seven, I'm, you know, I want to talk about a couple of amends that I've made recently, because I love amends. I hate doing them, but I better have God with me when I'm doing this, and last year I had like it was Easter Sunday, and I rode up and spoke at a meeting in Pasadena, and then I went over to the cemetery where I have 8 family members, you know, and I don't know how y'all do them out here, but we have a card, and the card is clear on what the harms are that we've caused. Because I'm not going to get up there and grovel about what happened, what I did. I'm really clear of the harms because I see them in my four step. And one of the questions we ask at the bottom of each resentment is, what are the harms you caused? So when they're fresh and alive in me, I want to think I can go back and remember them later, but there's no time like the present to really see what's going on, you know, living that. And I sat at the cemetery, and I went to my grandfather, you know, and I just sat in meditation, and I meditated, and the picture of him came to mind, sitting on my, as he would call the Davenport in the den, and he was sitting there, and I'm standing before him doing this amends, and I'm clear of the harms I've caused, of stealing his time, his peace, his sanity with me in this house, and the money that I've stole from him, and how I disregarded him completely and cared nothing about him at times in my life, you know, and then asking him, is there any harms that I'm unaware of, and letting him talk for a bit, you know, and telling him about the lonely nights that he was praying that I wasn't dead, you know, and it was like so real, it was just blew my mind, you know, and then asking him what I need to do, you know. And he says, you're doing it, you know, and having him get up and embrace me. It's like, I meditate a lot, you know, prayer and meditation is a place I'm at all the time, you know, on the plane, in the car, you know, at school, everywhere I pray and meditate. And it was just so real, man. You know, and then I went from him to my grandmother. And my grandmother, I just, anytime she was happy, I made her miserable. And anytime she was miserable, I was running around the happiest kid on earth. I was like, so destructive in her life and so mean to this woman who every indicator that she loved me beyond words could describe from the gifts that they gave me, you know. So I talked about what a victim I was as a child. They sent me to military school, English writing lessons, any instrument I wanted to play, private swim coaches. I mean, everything, the whole gamut of stuff. But I was so damaged, none of it meant anything to me. You know, and then I went to my great-grandmother, then my aunt, then my uncle. And when I walked out of the cemetery, I got to tell you, I was floating, man. It was like I was so connected to God, and I was so free of all this stuff that it no longer ever comes a part of my life anymore. You know, I guess I'll tell you about one more. I had this high school girlfriend that I laid it out there. I guess I might as well finish it, right? So I hadn't planned on it. You know, I'm not clear what my harms are until I look at all those past relationships, and I look at what were my motives for getting involved. You know, what are the major points that came up in the relationship? How is it now, or how did it end? And then there's a whole slew of other questions. You know, did I arouse bitterness? You know, jealousy? You know, and what should I have done instead? And it's not like not gotten the relationship at all. It's like I should have. You know, I'm going to use that to make my sex ideal. You know, to what I'm going to live towards in my next relationship, or the one I'm currently in. And I saw that I didn't even remember this girl's name, okay? I just knew that she was this chick from El Monte. But as I started doing it, I remember her name was Becky. And one of the things I did early on in my early years of drinking is like I would meet a gal in a bar and just go home with her, you know, and not leave. You know, she'd say, well, I'm going to work. And I'd go, have a great day, you know? You know? Where's the remote, you know? And I kind of just move right in the pad. And this particular morning, and I used to share about this in meetings, and it breaks my heart that this is what I used to think was funny. You know, it's like I would share meetings in my first 14 years about how one day I told her, you know, have a great day at work. And she said, okay. And this girl, I mean, she adored me, man. I don't know how that happened. But she, you know, she went to work and I packed all my stuff in a car and I split and I never saw her again, you know. And when I saw this and I thought back in my early recovery and how I used to share about this and everybody laughed at the meeting, how cool that was. It's pathetic. It's like how I could totally harm another human being, and not only harm her then, but to continue to in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that she's harmful. That wasn't the one I was going to tell you about, but the next one was this other one was my high school girlfriend, and you know, I just totally just like had no clue how to be a boyfriend. You know what I mean? I didn't know what you're supposed to do. You know, I used to like, you know, she lost her virginity to me, and I kind of pointed her downhill on this road and sent her home afterwards. And I went going through the work, I saw that that was totally objectionable, you know. So after like 35 years, I contacted her and made an amends for that. And it was just so amazing. It was like, you know, what was so crazy is she, when I talked to her about like who I was then and what was driving me, that fear drove my entire life, and that every part of my life was fear driven, and she's like, "You gotta be kidding me!" You know, it's because I was like, I mean, such a hard ass with that mask and that brain. We can mask that fear in all kinds of different things, and now we talk back and forth all the time. It's just, and I just want to touch on the fears real quick. I want to go back to the inventory, you know, because When I saw that I had 100 forms of fear, I really didn't believe that. I thought maybe I had 4 or 5. You know what I mean? And maybe one was being on the top of a telephone pole or something. You know. But when I go through this and I look at my fear and I've written my resentments and I've looked at the fear column, I mean, my fears are so different today from the first time I went through the work. The first time it was abandonment, unloved, uncared for, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at it after like the first 5 or 6 pages and I just went, this is so pathetic. You know what I mean? I was like, I cannot believe that this is what drove my entire life. You know? So we do like the extended fear because the book tells me we asked ourselves why we had this fear. So I go to the, you know, if I have a fear of being unsuccessful, You know, I have a fear of that. So what's the fear that's driving that? If I'm unsuccessful, I won't have anything. You know what I mean? If I don't have anything, I'll probably be alone. And what drives that is that no one will want to be around me. And what drives that is that, you know, I'll be a loser. And if I'm a loser, I could drink or those other non-AA approved substances. And then, and if I do that, I could die. And I got to see where self-reliance fails. So like me on my own power, this is all I can do. But then I have the flip side. I have a fear of being successful. So not only do I have a fear of not being successful, but I have a fear of being successful. Because if I'm successful, I'm going to fail. You know? And if I'm successful, then there's expectations. And if there's expectations, I know I'll fail because I'm a fraud. But blah, 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 blah. So like every part of my entire life is fear driven. You know? Every aspect of it. You know, I called it the spinning plate syndrome. I would wake up in the morning, start spinning the plate, put it at the bottom of the bed, say hi to my chick. Hey, what's up? You know? How are you, babe? You know, I'd spend that 30 seconds of quality time. And then run down the hall to my son and go, hey, what's up, dude? And spin another plate. And my whole day was spinning plates. You know, it's like, you know, run back, not knowing how to do it. You know, I had a business with a slew of employees, not knowing how to, you know, I was a business owner that did everybody's job because they couldn't do it good enough, you know? You know, it's like totally controlling everything. So when I get through this and they said, the fear is just like, I have my people that I take to the work that they read this prayer and it says, do I believe it's possible to have a relationship with God deep enough that I never feel not good enough, because in God's eyes, I am good enough. And as I start to read these fears, and I'm reading this while I'm getting ready to do my sixth, I got to tell you, they dissipate, man. There's not a situation where I don't walk into with the hand of God. And I, you know, they always say, I don't know if it's my will or God's will. Think about that the next time you're going to take God's hand into what you're doing. You know what I mean? If you're not going to take God's will into what you're doing, maybe it's not God's will. I don't know. You know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm stoked that you guys invited me out here, and I hope to see you all as we trudge the road to happy destiny. Thanks, man.